the Egyptian regime, silenced like many by resignation and the fear of reprisals, until he anonymously launched a Facebook campaign to protest the death of one particular Egyptian man at the hands of security forces. In his new memoir, Revolution 2.0, he tells us from his experience, from his perspective, why and how the Egyptian people finally rejected 30 years of oppression and found their voice. The Egyptian regime, silenced like many by resignation and the fear of reprisals, until he anonymously launched a Facebook campaign to protest the death of one particular Egyptian man at the hands of security forces. In his new memoir, Revolution 2.0, he tells us from his experience, from his perspective, why and how the Egyptian people finally rejected 30 years of oppression and found their voice. Let me read just two brief quotes from Moyal Ghanim. One, social media allow ideas to be shared. They are places where people can unite, revolutions can begin, a new type of revolution, Revolution 2.0. And then finally this quote, people have called me a hero, but that is ridiculous. This has not been a revolution of heroic individuals, but about people coming together to overcome dictatorship. The people is greater than the people in power. Welcome, Moyal Ghanim.
Welcome, and thanks for hosting me.
You're very welcome. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. Your memoir obviously does that. Briefly, give listeners the backstory. Who were you before you created a Facebook page for Khalid Said?
So I was just an Egyptian, an ordinary Egyptian who happens to work in a multinational company that loves the country, cares about it, but always intimidated by fear that, you know, there are consequences for opposing the regime, or also that there are no alternatives. Like there is no light at the end of the tunnel. We don't see where are we going. And I was more focusing on my personal life and on my career, you know, hoping to see something happen in Egypt that would be great. At the same time, there were many Egyptians, brave Egyptians on the front lines, publicly opposing Mubarak, calling for strikes and protests, which haven't really at the time captured a large audience or mainstream, mainly because of the fear. Everyone was scared.
And that fear was the fear of a security state and a state police, a security police. And you say that again. I'm placing you in the context. You have written that the internet has been instrumental in shaping my experiences as well as my character. What do you mean by that?
Well, the first time I got on a computer was when I was 16 years old. I was at school and I got hooked up. Just like many, many people, I got addicted to using computers. And since then, the computer was at that time my best friend. I logged in the internet when I was, I believe, 17 years old. And I started, I loved the virtual world. I've explained that in the book. I talked about it a lot. I love communicating with people from different countries, from different backgrounds. I love communicating with people whom I don't know, and I have no, there are no politics to worry about in communicating or, collaborating with them. And that played a big role in my life and my career. In fact, the first time I met my wife was online.
That's
on a discussion forum, and the first thing I've done was a website. It was an Islamic website that was sort of like a YouTube, but audios for the Arab world, which is one of the largest now until today when it comes to this category. And I came to learn a lot of stuff online, and the most important one was with collaboration and engagement. And I just love the internet. It's basically a platform that allows everyone, not just talented or gifted people, allows everyone to reach out to others. And what matters in this reach, without any filtration, without someone to come in as a gate to tell you what should you say, what you should not. And the best thing here is that the more the internet is growing, the more decentralized mainstream media gets, and the more empowered are the users rather than the experts. So in a sense, that was very good for me. I enjoyed, for example, doing business. You know, I was working for a company, a Gmail competitor, actually, before joining Google in the region. And I've done, you know, hundreds of transactions with customers and clients I've never met, I've never known, I've never talked to. It was all through, you know, the online communication. So that did definitely play a role. I call myself an internet, you know, extrovert and a real life introvert.
Mm-hmm.
I do love to communicate with people online more than I do offline.
Very understood. It also makes you in some sense, a new kind of citizen than was possible to exist before the internet, whether in Egypt or anywhere in the world. You spent 6 months, Wael Ghanim, in the U.S. in 2001 as a student. You arrived before 9/11. You left after. What was it like before, and what was it like after?
I think that the U.S., to many people from my region, have completely changed before and after. When I traveled to the U.S., it was mainly to continue my education. I detailed in the books saying, you know, why I was not happy with the way education is in the country. And I took a decision. I'm going to, you know, travel and try and see if I can continue studying in the U.S. But after September 11th, it completely, you know, everything completely changed. The media have basically launched a huge campaign against, you know, instead of against terrorism, it was against Islam and the religion, the Muslims who believe in the religion of Islam, as well as the Middle East. Whether it was intentional or unintentional, that wasn't the issue. The issue was, you know, personally, I felt I was singled out when I walked. Nothing bad happened to me, I have to say, but you know, the feeling of being singled out was not comfortable, and I just had, you know, I sat down with my wife and we talked for a while, and we agreed that let's go back to Egypt. Let's see if we can make it in Egypt, because the U.S. was getting harder to live in for someone who's from the Middle East, and especially also right after the events. You know, it's expected that people were be more, much more emotional over time. Things get better, but at that time, that was the peak of emotions and anger and frustration and the focus of the media on the stories. But that was, I think it was, after all, a good decision that I went back home. I'm happy that I did.
And but just if you could, before 9/11, so before 9/11, you're a young student with your wife in the U.S. What was that like? What did America feel like, look like to you? Because you are both a citizen of Egypt and a citizen of the internet, so in some sense a global citizen. What did the U.S. feel like prior to 9/11?
I was actually impressed. I remember the first time I visited the U.S., I went back home saying to my friends, we're fooled down here. Like, something is going on wrong. If that's, you know, if that's our country and they're convincing us that this is the best it can get, then there's definitely something wrong in those people. I really have had a lot of respect to the, you know, to the respect of human rights as well as the, you know, democracy, the freedom of speech. But, you know, at the same time, I was always wondering, especially coming from the Arab world, you know, how come this is not applied? Like, the U.S. that we see inside the U.S. is not the same as reflected on its foreign policy. Yet I was really impressed, and I was also impressed with the education and the level, you know, of education among the people I communicated with. It was just, as a young guy, you know, it's easy to get impressed by just flying to the U.S. In fact, many people from the country was, you know, their dream was always to go in the summer and visit the U.S. for a couple of months and go back and talk to everyone about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we've got that. You come, it's an eye-opening event, and then, of course, 9/11 happens and the feeling of being here changes. In your initial Google interviews, you were asked why you wanted to work for Google, which it's clear from your writing that you really did. And I believe you said that you wanted to help change the Middle East and that you even at that point, thought the internet was going to help make that happen.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't really about the meals at Google. It was mainly the belief. I had this long-lasting belief that internet was one of the hopes for change. It's a tool at the end of the day. Change happens by the people, but people need tools. And internet was great because, first of all, like a large number of Arabs in general were getting online. It just shows you the whole world. The access to information is very democratic, and it's easy to verify something and know about it. You can get to see the different points of views on any issue. People can collaborate and communicate effectively. So I just felt that it was a matter of time that the region changes. I remember in April 2010, I believe, I wrote that, which is like almost 1 year before the revolution, that no, internet will change the face of politics in this country, and the elections in 2011 was never going to be like the elections in 2005, referring to when Mubarak won the elections easily against his competitors. So with a company like Google, you know, the scale of change you can offer is huge. And this is not by actually getting involved in politics. It's just by providing people with the tools, and, you know, they are empowered to do whatever they want with it.
Exactly. The subtitle of your book, that's more than a subtitle to you, isn't it? The power of the people is stronger than the people in power. What do you mean by that?
It's what I felt right after 11th of February. And I just wrote it on Twitter. And after writing it, I asked myself, who said that? So I thought I copied it from someone. So I went to Google and I Googled it to make sure that, you know, I get the reference right. Who was the one who said it? And it wasn't anyone. So this is a true feeling of what I felt when it's been always the case in the past that people in Egypt were saying, this is their country, they are the strongest, they govern us, they, you know, no one can go against them. If you speak up, you're going to be arrested. You have to walk on the sidewalk, referring, you know, it's an Egyptian common saying that don't walk in the street or you will get yourself in trouble. So what happened in Tunisia on the 13th of January and then on the 14th of January was such an inspiration to a lot of us. Wow. All of a sudden, you see an Arab dictator. It was the first time in my whole life I see an Arab dictator addressing his nation saying, I am sorry, I was wrong. I am sorry, I understood you. And then the next day he escapes to Saudi Arabia. And that was the sign. When people are united, determined, they know what they want, and they're ready to pay whatever price to make it happen. It will happen regardless whomever in power, regardless what kind of power they have. You know, I truly believe that one big reason why 11th of February happened and Mubarak was forced to step down is that most of us did not really understand politics. Most of us were naive, to say, and we were not ready for any concessions. We did not want any deals cut. We just wanted him out. And this is exactly what happened. And this is what forced the meaning that once the people are united, their power is definitely greater than anyone who's in power with whatever weapons, tools they have.
And one of the sense I get also is that prior to this, even though the power, the Mubarak had been in power so long and everything had been handed over from one dictator to the next, even the hopes of people were usually in, what if we put someone else in power? You were involved in you put up a Facebook page for Mohamed El Baradei prior to the 2011 elections, right? So that was still a feeling that, not necessarily from you, but from the culture in Egypt, that the best we can do is change who is in power.
Yeah, I mean, to a large extent, we needed someone we trust that can bring change. And El Baradei, when he and before El Baradei comes to Egypt, I was not really interested in politics, just as I told you. One, because, you know, you are always scared of the consequences of doing that, especially if you work in a good company, if you have family. you will, you know, ask yourself 10 times before getting into this. And the second, which is as important, is that we had no hope. Like, so what? You know, what can happen? What? No one was envisioning how change will happen. When Muhammad al-Baradei started, you know, showing interest that he joins the change campaign in the country, and then some young activists online started calling him for, you know, to nominate himself for presidency, that seemed like a nice exit. That was like good. And he played a critical role at that time by saying, listen, I'm not running for presidency unless those seven things happen. And that was the seven demands, which I clearly explain in the book, like how the logic. But it was great how he came up with those demands and then started campaigning online and offline for people to sign and agree to. And the demands basically said, we're not going into a show called democracy. We need real democracy, and for that to happen, you need to make sure that, you know, the judges are the ones monitoring the elections, that Egyptians are voting, Egyptians abroad are voting, Egyptians vote with their ID cards, they don't have to go get other cards that complicate the matter, and so on. So at that time, I was giving a lot of attention to al-Baradei as a person, and you know, eventually hoping that change will happen. I clearly remember, you know, he said that if you are looking for a savior, I am not the savior. Egyptians have to save themselves. And that's why the second chapter of the book, as I named it, Searching for a Savior. We were looking for a savior. Mm-hmm. We wanted a magical solution. We wanted something crazy to happen. Someone comes in and we all go behind him and make it happen. But that wasn't the case.
Yeah, that is not what happened. Okay. Can you just provide a little bit of context for listeners who aren't aware? Egypt is an ancient civilization but has a very youthful population, nearly two-thirds 30 years old or under, and the numbers of educated and uneducated, the number of unemployed, the number of angry, the number of people who see no future. What is that like?
So before 2011, I think if the revolution gave us anything, it would be hope. A lot of people started to have hope that this can be better. In Egypt, you have almost one out of every two lives under $2 a day. So people are really suffering from poverty and having huge economical problems. And one out of every three, more than one out of every three, can't read and write. So there is another clear education problem. And then the country ranks very high when it comes to corruption in all levels, starting from the top to the bottom. There were corruption everywhere, in politics, in education, in health system. Everything was corrupted, and it was sort of a rotten regime leading us. And the level of frustration was very high. A lot of Egyptians, including my dad, left the country because basically the salary he makes in Egypt is one twentieth of the salary he could make in Saudi Arabia. So he left to Saudi Arabia, and so did millions of Egyptians who fled outside the country trying to find a better opportunity. And things were getting worse to the extent that a lot of Egyptians started getting on boats, hundreds and sometimes thousands on boats, trying to reach the other side of the Mediterranean Sea in Europe, risking their lives, and many people have died in this trip. But then, you know, those who survive come back and say, okay, I'm living dead. So what's the point? I would take the risk. Maybe I will have a better life when I cross the Mediterranean. Add to this the feel, you know, because of the regime was using fear, a lot of people were, you know, the sense of pride. Egyptians are very proud of their, you know, nationality. I remember the guy, I was interrogated by state security in 2007, and I told the guy, I love my country. He's like, you know, the interrogator was asking me, the state security interrogator was asking me why.
Why you loved Egypt?
I don't have an answer. I don't know. I mean, this is how it is. I have a very strong sense of love towards my country, which is not something normal. A lot of people love their countries and love where they were, where they were from. So, despite that, a lot of people became sort of like broken. They feel, you know, they cannot brag about being Egyptians, basically. So this revolution have brought back the pride. This revolution have brought back the hope that things would get better.
You, a turning point for you prior to the revolution is when you set up the Facebook page for Kaid. What drove you to that?
It's purely personal. I hate injustice. And when I saw the photo of Khaled Said, the young Egyptian who died after being brutally beaten up by two police officers in the street, I felt that this has to stop. I know he wasn't the first one, but he is the first one I see his photo after being beaten. And the fact that he was young, he comes from a middle class, did not only connect with me, but to many Egyptians. And that was a very strong turning point. I remember sitting down for some time, broken to tears in my room, thinking, what can I do? And I decided I have to take his case to public. I have to try and help, among many others who have done that, to make sure that this is a public case. Justice will be, justice will prevail, as well as work on the men, exposing what the dictator is doing. The worst thing for dictators and for oppressors, for people like the ministry, state security, is to expose them. They know they are doing something wrong. They want the knowledge to be very limited of what they were doing. And the more you expose them, the more you are putting pressure on them. And this is where I came from. So the page was mainly all about spreading the awareness and working with people trying to understand what can we do to fix the situation.
Right. So in other words, the state security apparatus wants people to know they're active enough that they have the fear, but not beyond that.
Yeah, they don't want, they only want the people to feel, the people who get to speak up to be scared and to know exactly what they do. And actually, sometimes they basically intentionally tells you what happens so that you are always scared. You
right.
are always intimidated. You are, you calculate your steps. They call you eventually. They call you every other week to know what you are doing and what you are up to. They tell you, we are after you. Be careful. But as you just said, that shouldn't be the case in public. That shouldn't be the public case. The public should not know about that because they were scared of a moment like what happened on Jan 25th. The more you do this, the more mounting anger, the anger mounts, and there will be a moment where, everyone is going to say, no, enough, and this is not going to happen anymore.
And then again, just to provide a little bit of the background, from the Facebook page, We Are All Kaid, you were organizing from that page, correct? Anonymously. But silent protests, silent demonstrations. What until everything shifted? What were you doing, and what were you hoping?
Well, I detailed the whole experience in the book because I have personally learned a lot through this process. It made me think, change a lot of my perceptions about how things should run for playing an active role. I was not an activist, and I think that was very good because most of the activists, they, get into situations where others don't see. For example, like human rights activists see the cases of, the torture cases, speak directly with the victims, get involved, get involved directly and see what is happening. Eventually, there is sort of a gap in communication that occurs unintentionally between them and the mainstream or the masses. And it's not always the case that they will know how to tell the people the reality and people connect with them. And I was not an activist. So when I created the page, the first day, 36,000 people joined it. And in 3 days, it was 100,000. It was obvious that the amount of frustration and anger was big. So what I've learned, and I've detailed this in the book talking about the campaigns, is that one, engagement was key. This wasn't a page where it tells people what to do. This was a page that asked people, what should we do? And based on their recommendations, create surveys, and based on the most, you know, liked choices, actions take place. Second is being the language being very, you know, talking the talk of the people. So I, again, unintentionally, it wasn't planned, because that was just me. I was always talking as I wasn't saying we, so that people understand that the guy running this page is writing with, you know, he's a one person. It's not a group going back, you know, sitting in the backyard and putting master plans and applying them on the page. It was a one person. And, you know, eventually I got a second administrator. His name is Abdurrahman Mansour. He was basically helping me out throughout the whole time. But we were always using I. We're always staying away from words like the regime. We say the government, because the, you know, the regime is not a word that most of the people connect with. It's such an activism related word.
Yeah, let me cut in for a second, Wael Ghanim. This distinction that you're making between what you were doing on Facebook, in the look of it, the feel of it, the language, and so on, separating not just from the government and the state security, but separating it in some way from ongoing activism. This was because it is how you saw things and how you thought things could broaden?
No, it wasn't. Actually, it wasn't separating things from activists. You know, activists' role is crucial and important. And what they were doing were basically, they were in the front lines. They were doing the right things and for their capacity. What we were missing were the crowd in the middle, where I come from. Which basically understand and relates to what the activists are doing, you know, to what the activists' demands are and what they were doing, and at the same time able to deliver the message to those who might not be interested or misunderstand the messages if it comes directly. So, and also there is another thing, which is, as you know, I was going to say, after the language, it was also very important to make sure that this is not confrontational. Most of the people were scared. I personally, you know, I'm intimidated, and I said it. I clearly, you know, expressed my real feelings throughout the whole journey in the book, and I wasn't shying away from saying that I'm someone who's always worried about the security of, you know, myself as well as the, you know, my family and everyone whom I ask to do something. So it was. The non-confrontational approach made a lot of people connect with the page. People do not want to, you know, to always be confrontational. There's always a smaller number of people who want to do that. And finally, the anonymity was critical, because not only for security reasons. I believe the cause was the hero. People joined this page not because Wael Ghanim from Google created it. It's because they care about Khaled Said. They care about the cause. They are not happy with the Ministry of Interior Affairs. So the anonymity added a lot of, you know, on the contrary of what many people would think, it added a lot of legitimacy to the page. Why? Because people did connect directly with the cause. They did not feel someone was taking credit or too much credit for their contributions. And the cause was not personalized. The moment you personalize the cause, it could be attacked through the person. You can question the intentions of the person. You can basically, you know, defame the person, say that, you know, find anything wrong with them and make it a clear case so people would not connect with the cause. And finally, personalizing the cause could get people who believe in the cause not to join you because of the fact they don't like you. They have a personal preference against you and they don't like you as a person. It just, all of this just played very well. Probably I'm articulating it now in a good way. It just happened at that time. There was, you know, it wasn't like I'm sitting down making all these conscious decisions except the anonymity one, which I consciously made.
Right. Well, it seems like it also is very true, again, to that line, the subtitle of your book, the power of the people is greater than the people in power. Even, you're saying that even about the person who might be in power behind a Facebook page or behind a cause.
Absolutely. I mean, if that call did not make sense, no one have, you know, because there has been many calls before. It's just the fact that, you know, the people believing and subscribing into a cause, being determined to do it, ready to sacrifice for it, it will, you know, that cause will happen. Especially at, in our time, like, hardly anyone would argue that what we are in was very bad and the regime need to go. And that was, you know, the biggest thing. And I also have to say that, you know, in the book I was trying to explain how ideas were just coming mostly from the members of the page. Mm-hmm. So the silent stands were the first on-the-ground activity I started calling on the page was not even my idea. It was an idea from a guy who emailed me, said, you know, listen, I know you said we are not protesting because you're afraid of, you know, what happens to the protesters. So how about we go in all wearing black, looking at the beach, giving our backs to the street, standing up for 1 hour, doing nothing, and then going back home. And when I read the idea, I started to visualize it, and I was like, wow, that's a very good idea. So what we do next, I asked the people on the page, saying, what do you think we should do this, if we should do
right,
this?
Right.
And surveyed the people. The people liked the idea. We, you know, started collecting ideas from people on how to make it nice. People said bring Quran or the Bible, listen to something, don't hold each other hand, try to spread. And, you know, people were developing the idea as we go until we went to the street on that day. And the moment you see the footage coming in, that was another, you know, lesson learned, because people were very happy sharing their photos. Why? Because of the instantaneous feedback they get. There was instant feedback. As the moment you upload the photo on the page, hundreds of likes, tons of comments, and it just makes everyone happy that they took part of this. So all of this did play a critical role in building the, you know, the DNA, the credibility between the page members and the page, despite the fact that they don't know who is running it.
Right. Well, I mean, that's by its very nature, in some sense, they are. They are running it, right?
Yeah, that's what I kept always saying.
And it was pretty much in actuality true. As we bring it sort of chronologically up, we're at the point where there are demonstrations starting. The page exists, but we're nowhere near a revolution. Now, at that point, you're polling people, and you call in late 2010 for a celebration of Egypt's National Police Day on the 25th, correct? What was your sense of that?
4 days before the 30th, Abdurrahman Mansour, the other administrator, came and told me, you know, the police day is on 25th. That was, we should do something. And I told him, I don't think so. You know, it's a Tuesday. Because we used to do our activities on Fridays, which is the weekend in Egypt. So he said, no, it's a day off. We started thinking, okay, what can we do? And it was all about, you know, let's do a silent stand. Maybe he suggested that we do a list of, you know, honor to honor all those good police officers and, you know, and a wall of fame and a wall of shame for the bad ones. And at that time, we didn't know what exactly will happen. So I posted on the 30th of December that, you know, these guys are basically doing a lot of bad things in the past 1 year, and until now, nothing have happened in the case of Khaled Saeed. How about we, you know, we see what, you know, what can happen. So I posted it and waiting, you know, I was trying to get some suggestions from the people. I started talking to some activists like Ahmed Maher from 6th of April, asking him, you know, what should we do? And at that time, it was just, you know, we were going to do something that 1,000 or a couple of thousand people do it. But the moment when Ben Ali made his speech, that was a turning point in personally for me. I started feeling more, you know, more revolutionary, which is not me, than, you know, than a normal, ordinary person. I was completely against the idea of launching massive protests before, and I even wrote about that on 7th of January. But then what Ben Ali did and then his escape just made me forget all that. And I said, you know, we have to do it, looking at the comments of the people, we've got to do exactly like what Tunisia did, even if it comes at the expense of my personal life. And I was very serious about it. I put the first post, then created the, you know, the renamed the event, recreated it, called it a revolution, and instead of a celebration of the police day, I said the revolution on unemployment, injustice, torture, and corruption.
And so suddenly what had been celebrating Egyptian Police Day, January 25, becomes January 25, Revolution Against Torture, Corruption, Unemployment, and Injustice. And at that point, to some extent, for you at least, the die has cast and you've shifted.
Now, yeah, completely. And it wasn't just me. It was basically everyone in Egypt. Everyone in the critical mass who went on 25th, you know, let's not generalize. So everyone on the critical mass who went on 25th just felt that this is the moment. It's our moment. We will make it. We will do it. And the feedback was enormous. In a couple of days, the invitation on Facebook reached about 500,000 people. And there was about 27,000 confirmations. I have experience with other Facebook events. And, you know, the largest I have seen was a 12,000 people confirmation. So
in other words, two things happen. One, the ante is up as to what we're doing. And two, it turns out that brings out a much greater response.
Huge response. It made sense. And I think the fact that the page, not a political movement, not a biased individual, were calling for it, made it easy for others to adopt and own. And there was no owner of the, you know, of the invitation. And this is exactly why I don't like the fact that I've been much more exposed and taking a lot of credit, while many others have worked and many others have had a lot of influence on what happened on Jan 25th. But, you know, I call that period one of the best marketing campaigns, and I tried to detail what happened exactly, not as in just saying the story, but, you know, doing some respect, you know, reflections and what was going on that made a lot of people adopt the call, and not only that, work on the marketing campaign for it, and so that we can see what we have seen on 25th of January.
Okay, so let me ask one more time. You've brought it up a couple of times, but was there an offline grassroots uprising of the poor or the workers, for instance, that your online-inspired uprising joined with?
There was definitely, in 2010, there was about 1,000 strikes and sit-ins by workers. And
okay.
There were, you know, a few tons of protests against, you know, the regime in general, small protests. Would this revolution have happened? I believe it would have happened eventually, because at the end of the day, there is a level where people will be super frustrated and say, that's it. This is no longer happening. Tunisia did speed this up, though, accelerated it. And the internet helped organize the day on Jan 25th. So it gave it sort of a style and a taste and made it look like what is it on Jan 25th. But definitely we were heading towards, you know, a deadlock where it will have, you know, this regime will have to be taken out of power. So it was very critical to understand that this was going to happen anyway, probably not on Jan 25th, but because of the internet and because of Tunisia, it happened this way. It happened on 25th, and it happened by an invitation online that was, you know, that spread it from online to offline. And by the way, all the grassroots movements joined the call, and that was very essential. If all of them said, no, we're not going, and this is wrong, probably it wouldn't have happened.
Right. In other words, if the grassroots folks had said, that's a different movement than ours, the reality would never have happened.
Yeah,
but
at the end of the day, internet is not, you know, those who are online are not, you know, does not belong to a specific movement. They come from these grassroots movements. People, I was always arguing with my friends who think internet is not gonna do anything, and so on. I was like, those who are online are not zombies. They are real Egyptians. You know,
yes.
The fact that they are more brave online than offline can change. Something can happen that can change that. But at the end of the day, it wasn't the tool. It wasn't the internet that made the revolution. It was the people. And it wasn't the power of social media. It was the power of the people.
Absolutely. So you were captured on January 27th, just as the revolution took off. You were held for 11 days of interrogation. What happened? What do you want to say about that period for you?
Well, I think you are, you know, why would people read my book then?
Very good. Okay, so if you want to hear about the interrogation, you read the book.
Well, it's I detailed the whole interrogation
yes.
and the prison, but the hardest thing that I went through was that I did not know what was going on outside. I was all the time blindfolded, and I was waiting for the unknown. I was waiting, you know, the hours seemed like days, the days seemed like months, and the months seemed like years. I just lost track of the time,
yeah.
With the exception of when I pray, I know what time is it, but I lost track of the days.
Mm-hmm.
It was very hard. I was just praying that something happens and get me out of here. I wanted to know exactly what was going on outside. And this, you know, I have to say that I was very lucky because I wasn't physically tortured, you know, probably beaten up here and there, but that is not torture as per what generally happens to people. There were people who died inside prisons in Egypt while being tortured, and there are people who spent months and months in that. So I was very lucky that it was only 11 days, and it was basically basically blindfolding being handcuffed, and that's all about it.
Very good. You have thanked the regime of Hosni Mubarak for making their overthrow inevitable.
Yeah.
And I've seen you say it on 60 Minutes and so on. What do you mean when you're saying that?
I think what happened, the reaction to what was happening, was the main reason why he got out of power. Basically, they completely undermined what was going to happen on Jan 25th, before Jan 25th. They ignored, you know, all the... I remember one of my friends who's now a parliament member, he was part of the whole movement from the beginning. He wrote a letter to Mubarak on 23rd of January saying that it's about time, you have to listen. And of course, you know, they completely did not think anything will happen. And when people took to the street on 25th, and instead of negotiating with the young guys, who came, by the way, at that time, we had demands. Those demands were, you know, firing the Minister of Interior Affairs, making sure there's a minimum wage, like normal demands. If they came on Jan 25th, midday, and said, okay, we're doing 1, 2, 3, 4, that's it, that would have been at least created a friction between the activists and the
mm-hmm.
people who are in the street,
right?
Whether they should stay or leave. They decided to use tear gas and rubber bullets, water hoses, beat up everyone, force people to leave the square, which made people more persistent. One of my friends was interrogated, that same guy that I was just referring about.
Yeah.
I was referring to. He was interrogated by them, and on the night of 25th, they arrested him. The guy told him, "Do you think you guys can go in thousands in the street and get us out of power? You are dreaming. You don't understand the Egyptian security." So they were completely arrogant. They did not see it happening. And then the lousy step of cutting down the internet and phone was very important because it just showed the whole Egypt that they are scared.
Right. In other words, while
the worst thing you show to the person who is
yes.
fighting you is to show him that you are scared.
And so people who weren't closely involved suddenly lost their phone or lost their internet. And so now it was like they came and told you, you may not have been paying attention. We're scared.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that did definitely create anger and as well as made a lot of people join just because of the fact that this looks like it's happening. The regime is afraid.
If they're reacting this way, it must be happening.
Of course.
Yeah.
And then eventually, through the process, they did not understand the demands. I think they have done a lot of mistakes. The camel battle after Mubarak's speech, as you know, they were just, it was overwhelming, and they did not see it happening. They did not understand the young people, especially they haven't been communicating with them anyway. All of a sudden, those, you know, people revolt, and you see an Egypt that you never saw before. Everyone was impressed and surprised.
Right, that no one had known that this was there. Let's move to the present, because we don't have that much time left. A year ago today, the protests were taking place. The recent parliamentary elections in Egypt have given first and second place to the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamic Party, the Noor. Where do things stand? What is it? And then last week, perhaps as many as 70 die after a soccer game, and now there are riots in various cities. What's your sense of where Egypt is and where the revolution is today?
First, I have to say, you know, I'm very sorry about all those who died, and I think this is one of the biggest problems we are facing, and we have been facing, is that the value, the life of the Egyptian people is not as valuable as we wanted it to be in the eyes of the regime or whomever is in power. And this must change, and we're all working on this. I believe that the situation in Egypt can be seen from different angles, and it's definitely complicated. It's not zero or one. There's a huge gray area. And if we look at the achievements, I believe we have achieved things that if you tell me 13 months ago it would have happened, I think you are crazy. You know, Mubarak stepping down, his son is in prison, his government is no longer there, his party is dissolved, and then, as you've just mentioned, for the first time in 60 years, 27 million Egyptians go to the street, waiting in lines, and voting for whomever they want in the parliament. So those are amazing achievements. No one have envisioned this. No one have seen it coming. And we have to just celebrate our success. But at the same time, there are many people who died, and there haven't been real trials for those who killed them, or real investigations, which is one thing that really makes all of us angry and not happy and satisfied. And in the pace of the transitional process is basically not acceptable, and for many of the Egyptians, and they want to see a president as soon as possible. They want the country to end the military rule, which lasted for over 60 years now, to end as soon as possible, so that we start looking for the next steps. We took to the streets not just for democracy. One of the main reasons is economy. We wanted social justice. We wanted people to live a better life, especially if almost 50% of the people are living under the poverty line. But I just think that the revolution is a process. A critical mass of Egyptians have broken their fear.
Right.
And a larger group have been more politically active. So people are now voting. People are following the news. I mean, on the first parliamentary session, you know, in coffee shops, people were sitting down watching it as if it's a very, you know, critical and important soccer game. So this is where we are heading. We're heading towards the right direction, I believe. The pace is very slow. It's disappointing a lot of us, including myself. Yet I have to remain personally optimistic, and I have to look at the bright picture, and not just you know, that doesn't mean escape from the problems, because definitely we have to face the problems, but the civilization, the progress, the new Egypt we want is not going to be you know, it's not going to happen if we all think that we're doomed.
Yeah, let me read. There was a line in a review of your book in the Philadelphia Inquirer that I'd like to read, and it's this: there is an energy in the book and in Ghonim's words that makes one feel it is much too soon to assume the revolution is over, or to underestimate what the rebels achieved. Your thoughts?
Well, in the prologue, I mentioned clearly that it's not over, and it will not be over until we achieve the goals, and it will not be successful until the democratic transition of power happens. And those are the things we all should be working on. Yet the revolution on an individual basis for Egyptians is sort of, it achieved its objective. I don't think the brave guys, the brave girls who took to the street and who stood against, you know, tanks, who opened their chests and were ready to take shots, are going to be afraid again. And this is it. we needed a critical mass of Egyptians who are always brave and ready to sacrifice for the right cause.
Right. Now, you say that history will ultimately be the judge of whether the revolution happened too soon, whether it needed more planning, whether it needed more leadership, and so on. And really, as you look at it today, that's still the case, right? History will ultimately, when you say that, are you thinking a year, 2 years, 3 years? What are you thinking when you'll be able to say, you know, give an assessment?
I think it would be. It takes more time to judge. Yet it's important that we look at it from time to time to see if we're in the right direction or not, given that we have, you know, we have list of what we want to achieve: democracy, and then social justice, for example, and freedom. So now I can still see that we are in the right track despite the challenges. There's a very strong challenge coming in, which will be significant in determining the path, which is the presidential election, as well as writing the constitution. And, you know, ensuring that the military is not going to get any special privileges over the president or in the constitution. This is very critical. Yeah, it is. I see it happening. I think it will be very – everything is happening now in a fast pace. You know, books are written about the revolution within the same year.
Yes.
In the past, it used to be after 40 years, people tell you what happened.
Right.
So everything is happening in a very fast pace. While we should be happy with that pace and we should keep going and running, we shouldn't just underestimate the fact that, you know, we are recovering from 60 years of military rule, 30 years of dictatorship. Things are not going to happen like this.
Yeah, that there is a mentality that must be overthrown as well as a leader.
And I believe so.
And it will take time. Again, we're at the end of the conversation. Now, the book is Revolution 2.0, The Power of the People is Greater than the People in Power. To learn more, go to hmhbooks.com, hmhbooks.com, or any of the book-selling websites or bookstores, your independent bookstores. I was in Skylight the other night. It's there. And finally, my deep thanks to Wael Ghanim. Keep up your good work.
Thanks, and thanks for hosting me.
You're very welcome.